Some of the most severe words in all the Bible are not addressed to sinners who are broken and ashamed of their wrong, but are addressed to the proud, to the self-righteous, to those who are smug in their own self-confidence. Remember the list of the seven things that God hates in the book of Proverbs. Remember the first thing on the list? A proud look. Some translations render that haughty eyes. Of all the things that God hates, if that list is in the order of importance, then haughty eyes, or carrying oneself in pride, would be the thing that God hates the most. In Luke chapter 18, I'd like you to turn there for a few moments. The subject is prayer. And while on that subject, Jesus is encouraging his listeners not to lose heart. And after giving them a parable that lasts from Luke 18:2 down through verse 8, he comes in verse 9 to a second parable, a second story that illustrates the great importance of not just prayer, but the right attitude when you pray. In verse 9, we read, he told this parable to certain ones who, now mark the three characteristics of pride, who, one, trusted in themselves. So there's a self-sufficiency about the proud. Second, they that considered themselves righteous. So there's a self-righteousness about the proud. And those who view others with contempt. There is a self-appointed critic attitude among the proud. Now don't miss the three characteristics. We'll deal with it throughout the message. Self-sufficiency, self-righteousness, self-appointed critics or judges. Those are characteristics of pride, and God hates them. Then he says, two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax gatherer. One very religious, one not religious at all. The Pharisee stood and was praying thus to himself, God, I thank thee that I am not like other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax gatherer. I fast twice a week. I pay tithes of all that I get. But the tax gatherer, standing some distance away, look at the contrast, was even unwilling to lift up his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. Not simply a sinner, but as far as that tax gatherer was concerned, he was the only sinner around. God, be merciful to me, the one who does not deserve even to be heard, the sinning one. And Jesus' response is one of the great axioms of his teaching. The following verse, I tell you, Jesus no longer teaching a parable, but teaching a truth from it. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. Why? Here's the principle. For everyone who exalts himself shall be humbled. But he who humbles himself shall be exalted. Look for a few moments at that last sentence we just read, beginning with the word for. Just study it for a moment or two. There's not an exception. It says everyone. A study in contrasts. Every person who exalts himself is a promise, shall be humbled, shall be lowered, shall be reduced, shall be diminished, But he who humbles himself shall be exalted. God has left us a lasting reminder of this single principle in the smallest book of the Old Testament. Because of its place in the minor prophets, it looks almost like it's a flyleaf to the book of Jonah, frankly. Jonah gets all the attention in this section, not Obadiah. But frankly, there is a message in Obadiah that really does set us up for understanding God's dealing with Jonah in the book of Jonah. There is in Obadiah this great throbbing theme that comes time and again to the attention of the reader. We've missed it. The book of Obadiah is a mystery to most Christians. We haven't the slightest idea what it's about. There are verses that seem mysterious to us and even weird. But it's a great book that says, those that exalt themselves will be humbled. The proud will be brought low. Now, if it's true that the smallest packages are the best gifts, then Obadiah certainly will not let us down. It is a book of only 21 verses. We don't know anything about the writer. Nothing, except his name is Obadiah, which means worshiper of Jehovah or servant of Jehovah, and that he had a vision, verse 1, and that he wrote it down, verse 1, and that's it. Now, he is the most obscure of all the Old Testament prophets. Nothing else is known about him. He writes strange things like verse 3, the arrogance of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock. Who would live there? He even says, verse 4, though you build high like the eagle, though you set your nest among the stars. What does that mean? From there I'll bring you down, declares the Lord. And look at verse 12, for example. Do not gloat over your brother's day. What does that mean? The day of his misfortune. Who is the brother? What is the misfortune? And I fear that in our hurried pace, we come to Obadiah, and without going to a little trouble of examining the background, it just kind of falls on deaf ears. We shrug our shoulders and say, it's another one of those strange minor prophets. No wonder they're minor. And you go on to Jonah. There's nothing minor about the message. As a matter of fact, it is potent. It is even severe. It's delivered to people who were proud. Well, let's get a little background for it, because without that, you can't appreciate what he says, of course. Historically, you may be surprised to know that the background of Obadiah is a family feud, far, far worse than the Hatfields and the McCoys in America. Far worse than the prejudice between blacks and whites in America. Far worse than the rivalry between any two athletic teams. Probably the closest illustration to the rivalry or the bad blood would be that which dwells constantly between the Israelis and the Arabs. Young man in our church recently returned for his sister's wedding. He lives in Israel in Tel Aviv, and I asked him yesterday. He visited with us up at the church office here. I said, tell me, do you know of, is it conceivable that any Arab would choose to live in Israel? And he almost laughed out loud when he said, an Arab living in Israel? Yeah, no chance. I mean, the rivalry is so severe and bad between them, you wouldn't even consider it. Bombs going off all the time. Not uncommon for people to guard that area with loaded weapons at every gate, at every terminal, not just at the airport. There is a family feud going on, and This goes back centuries to a set of twins born into the family of those ancient Jews. And those twins were named Jacob and Esau. Isn't it interesting we say it that way, even though the older was Esau? We really should say Esau and Jacob. But you see, Jacob ripped off his brother Esau. He took advantage of him, and as a result, the blessings fell on Jacob, the younger, rather than Esau, the older. And Esau never forgot it. Being a man of passion and a man of fleshly appetite, he went for the food, and he cared little for that document that declared his rights as the older. And he gave it all up, and Jacob, chiseler that he was, got it from him and cashed in on the benefits. Oh, and Esau never forgot it. Time passed. Esau lived like a Bedouin in the desert until finally he settled in the land of Edom, E-D-O-M. A little finger of land south of the Dead Sea that runs about 100 miles long and about 30 to 50 miles wide. The descendants of Esau finally settled in Edom. There they lived. But they did more than live. They lived for the sole purpose of making life miserable for the Israelites. Why? Because of the family feud. Because of hatred toward the Jews. Because Jacob took advantage of our forefather Esau. You know, in Numbers 20, when the people of Israel, having left through the marvelous provision of God's miracle at the Red Sea, that Exodus, they got to the Edom country and they wouldn't let them through. Read it for yourself. No way. Edom was going to let the pressure off of the Israelites. Not only did they dwell in the land of Edom, they dwelt high in the land. One of the seven wonders of the world originally was Petra. It still stands. Standing 700 feet high, there are buildings and homes chiseled out of solid rock on the side of a mountain. Can be seen to this day. The sun sets, there's kind of a pink color that comes out from that area. But I'll tell you, it is a rugged landscape across the side. It is a formidable, impregnable fortress, or so they thought. They would go down and buzz the community, make life miserable, carry out very unfair trade among the Israelites. And then, after the skirmishes, they would hurry back to their formidable posts high on the hillside and look down and laugh like crazy. As a matter of fact, when Jerusalem fell on several occasions, Edom rejoiced in the calamity. Edom sat in its perch and said, they said to themselves, how great it is to see our brothers hurt. Year after year passed, and the prejudice just increased. And it looked like Edom would be there forever, and Israel would be under the gun forever. With cruel, ornery delight, they took pleasure in Israel's pain. Hold your place at Obadiah just for a moment. Look at Psalm 137. The psalmist writes it at a low ebb in Judah's history. Psalm 137, they are in captivity. The people of Jerusalem have been taken captive. The city is a smoldering ruins. If you wonder what it was like, read Lamentations. Jeremiah laments over the city. Now, the psalmist writes what life was like. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst of it, we hung our harps, for there our captors demanded of us songs, our tormentors mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. Sing one of those choruses. Sing one of those Israeli songs. We'd love to hear it in Babylon. Verse 7, remember, O Lord, against the sons of Edom, the day of Jerusalem. That's the day we fell. Who said, raise it, tear it down, tear it down to its very foundation. Edom stood by and watched Jerusalem go under as the boot of Babylon walked right across her, and Edom sat in its perch and applauded. That's the way to go, Babylon. There's a perfect illustration of the cruel, revengeful attitude that the people of Edom had toward Jerusalem, toward Judah, toward the Israelites. Now, if you go back to Obadiah, I want to make it personal right now, and then we'll go further into the text itself. What is the personal and current relevance of the book? Let's understand it on the front end. You've gotten the historical background. Obadiah writes his vision as a constant warning to those who would take delight in their enemy's failure. To the Christians who live today who find themselves vengeful, who down underneath when they hear of the calamity of a brother or a sister, and down inside there is a quiet applause that says it's about time. He had it coming. The book of Obadiah stands as a permanent reminder. Those who have that attitude will be reduced to nothing. It's very, very easy for the proud to feel secure when things are going our way. Very easy. And to feel even better when those who did us wrong get it in the neck. But I'll tell you, in a brief moment of time, we can be reduced to rubble. It can happen just like that. Dear young man in our neighborhood, just an epitome of health, bright-minded student at UCI, on his way to a very fine future. Traveling up in the Visalia area to visit his fiancée, momentarily went to sleep at the wheel. Had a head-on collision with a semi. He may not live. His parents are there, exhausted, caring for him physically as best they can. In and out of consciousness. I can't remember the number of fractures and the condition of the young man, aside from a collapsed lung and neurological problems. They're crushed ankle and foot and the broken pelvis and thigh, on and on and on. And just days ago, the bright young student of the area, just happens like that. Guillermo Vilas is a tennis player, if you're into that, who is Argentine's finest. And one lady said in an article recently in Sports Illustrated, if I could just touch the hem of his garment, I could be healed. Kind of clout the guy has over there. Vilas was interviewed by Sports Illustrated, and in the interview he said this: fervently, I think that many times one feels oneself to be secure, and suddenly one's world falls down like a pack of cards in a matter of seconds. If you've had that happen, you know what I mean. That's the message of Obadiah. The proud who stand in their high places and say, aha, destroy them. Watch out. Your day is coming. Obadiah says the vision has come from God to the proud who live today. God notices the Edomites of every generation and deals severely with them. Now, we need a careful look into the book itself. What's true for a nation is true for people in this fiendish appetite to see people hurt who have hurt us at one time. Okay, first we have in verses 1 through 9 the humiliation and the destruction of Edom predicted. Strong, vicious, verbal assault against the nation. Watch how it unfolds. The vision of Obadiah. Thus says Jehovah. Notice the prophet's not speaking, God speaking. Thus says Jehovah God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord. And an envoy has been sent among the nations, saying, Arise, let us go against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You are greatly despised. The arrogance of your heart has deceived you. Easiest thing in the world for that to happen. Arrogance deceives. Arrogance says, you're secure, Vilas says. Learn the truth. You can be secure in a moment, and moments later, head-on collision. Heart attack. Loss of finances. End of success. I will make you small. Your heart has deceived you. You who live in the clefts of the rock, in the loftiness of your dwelling place, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to earth? There's an arrogance there. There's this sense of self-sufficiency. And in weak moments, all of us have those feelings at times. And then he describes them. Though you build high like the eagle. You understand that now. High upon the hill, Petra. Bozrah, another city up there. Selah, another city. We'll read of it in a moment. Those high places, though you build high up there near the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If thieves came to you, if robbers by night, oh, how you will be ruined. You see, they were saying while they dwelt up there, no one can reach us. It's impossible for them to climb these rocks and get into our dwelling places. We are in an absolutely secure place. How you will be ruined. Verse 6, how Esau will be ransacked and his hidden treasures searched out. Now look at 7. It troubled me when I began to study this book because it didn't seem to make sense, this business about the bread. All the men allied with you will send you forth to the border. That seems to be a sort of a backfire, allies turning against them. And the men at peace with you will deceive you and overpower you. There'll be a backlash of power, and those that are saying they're your friends will turn against you. And then the translators have added, they who eat your bread will set an ambush for you. But literally it says, your bread they have laid as a festering wound under you. What does that mean? How does bread become a festering wound under a proud nation? Theodore Leitch, in his excellent work on the Minor Prophets, helps us understand what this means. Recent explorations have thrown light on these enigmatic words. At Azion Geber, which is a dig near Edom, at Azion Geber was found an elaborate complex of industrial plants devoted to smelting and refining of copper, of which great quantities abound in this immediate vicinity. Iron also was treated in this plant. This area was the Pittsburgh of Palestine. This industry was one of the chief sources of Edom's wealth and political influence, so that it might well have been called the bread of Edom. Just as one would say steel is the bread of Pittsburgh, or fishing is the bread of Galveston, that type of thing. And this bread, the copper and iron they had exported to the neighboring countries, will come back to them in the form of swords and spears and chariots and other instruments of war used in attacking Edom, and will be laid under Edom like a festering wound, sapping its very life. An interesting comment. They have exported their steel, their copper, and they've ripped off countries as they've sold it for exorbitant prices. But those implements of war will be made and used against you, Edom, you who feel so secure. A word of warning to America as well. Huh? Releasing our precious treasure into the hands of our enemies only to see the use of those being used against us. Against us. And here's a proud soul in Edom who says, I cannot be touched. And along comes the Lord and says, you're just living on borrowed time. Verse 9, your mighty men will be dismayed, O Teman, another city, in order that everyone may be cut off from the mountain of Esau by slaughter. When you take refuge in your might, you take refuge in a very temporary source of strength. Whether it's your own personal might or the might of your power that you've amassed in your business. Spurgeon, in the height of his ministry, once wrote, "Success can go to my head, and it will, unless I remember that it is God who accomplishes the work, that He can continue to do so without my help, and that He will be able to make out with other means whenever He cuts me down to size." Beautiful attitude from that man of God. At any time God sovereignly chooses, He can slice the rug out from under us and cut us right down to size. Present-day Edomites, whoever we may be, hear the warning from the book. Though we dwell high, He can bring us down. It's predicted, verses 1 through 9. Now, in verses 10 through 14, there are reasons why. They're spelled out. He describes the cruelty and the crimes of this nation. Because, see how the verse begins, verse 10? Here are the reasons that the calamity will come upon you. Because of violence to your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame. You will be cut off forever. On the day that you stood aloof, look at the crimes, they stood aloof when Jerusalem needed them. When the strangers carried off his wealth, you didn't step in and help. Foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem. You too were as one of them. And along with watching passively, they gloated over their brother's day, the day of his misfortune. He says, don't do that. Don't rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Do not gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster. Do not loot their wealth in the day of their disaster. Do not stand at the fork of the road to cut down their fugitives. Do not imprison their survivors in the day of their distress. One of the telltale signs of an unresolved bitterness, these very things right here. The sense of pleasure in another's calamity. That goes on in the family of God. Someone does us wrong, and wrong indeed. Undeserved treatment. And if the truth were known in our weak moment, we wait in the lurch, anticipating that He'll get it back. Hold your place here in Obadiah, verse 14, and turn to a couple of sections in previous. Chapter 49 of Jeremiah, writing of the same people. Jeremiah 49:13. These are rugged words from the prophet, 49:13. I have sworn by myself, declares the Lord, that Bozrah, that's one of the cities of Edom, Bozrah will become an object of horror, a reproach, a ruin, and a curse. And all its cities will become perpetual ruins. By the way, that has happened. You'll not find dwelling places, that is, dwellers in the city, Petra. You will, in fact, not find Edom among the nations today. As one source declared, it is now a forgotten memory. I've heard the message from the Lord, and an envoy is sent among the nations, saying, gather yourselves together and come against her and rise up for battle. See, the Lord is at work against Edom. Drop down to verse 16. As for the terror of you, the arrogance of your heart has deceived you, O you who dwell, who live in the clefts of the rock, who occupy the height of the hill, though you make your nest as high as an eagle's, I will bring you down, declares the Lord. Edom will become an object of horror. Everyone who passes by it will be horrified and will hiss at its wounds. Kind of a or that kind of thing. Like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah. No one will live there, nor will a son of man reside in it. And earlier, just one, Proverbs 16:18. Look at that, please. You know the verse, but perhaps did not know where it was found. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before stumbling. Now, there is not an exception. That is an axiom that is illustrated in Obadiah, but is threaded throughout Scripture. No way can you claim any sense of deliverance if that attitude is within you and you carry it, you harbor it. You are a grudge keeper or a vengeful type. And who of us doesn't know something against someone that could be used against him? The Christian response, as illustrated so clearly from Jesus' words, is the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Now, in the last part of Obadiah, verses 15 to 21, we have the ultimate judgment and doom. In poetic form, the writer predicts the annihilation of a nation. Verse 15, "For the day of the Lord draws near on all the nations." Now watch it. Here is a key line in the book. "As you have done, it will be done to you." Mark that. "As you have done, laid back, stood aloof, laughed at calamity, applauded the wrong done against them, so God will do to you. Your dealings will return on your own head." Who hasn't experienced it? "Just as you drank on my holy mountain, all the nations will drink continually. They will drink and swallow and become as if they had never existed. But on Mount Zion there will be those who escape. It will be holy. The house of Jacob will possess their possessions. You, in fact, will not linger. Jacob will go on and on. They are my perpetual people. I preserve them." Last part of verse 18, "The Lord has spoken." This is not the word of Obadiah. This is the Lord. He describes in specific detail, verses 19 and 20, how even the exiles will be there. Verse 21, "The deliverers will ascend Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esau, and the kingdom will be the Lord's." In other words, he will have the last voice. He will have the last say. And the proud, in Spurgeon's words, will be cut down to size. Now, I've chosen an application of this, aside from what we have shared, kind of a summation in three statements of what I really believe that Obadiah is teaching. Here's the first one, and I think it's clear from what we've seen in the book. If you hold grudges or attempt to take revenge, your own failure is certain. If you are a grudge holder or a revenge keeper or taker, I should say, you take revenge, your own failure is certain. What is it Romans 12 says? "Vengeance is mine. I will repay. Leave it to me. I know the wrong done against you. I know the unfair treatment. I know the things that are said. Let me deal with them. You forgive. Leave it to me to take vengeance. I can do it thoroughly. I just like I brought Edom down, and it is a hollow echo as the wind whistles through those buildings today, through the stone. Remember, as a constant mute reminder of my sovereign power. Don't you attempt to take vengeance. I'll do it," says God. If you do, you're certain to fail. Here's the second. If you are proud and find pleasure in another's calamity, your own success will diminish. I am often haunted by the words of the New Testament that we rejoice with those that rejoice, and the genuine spirit-filled Christian weeps with those who weep, and there is no condition. When those around weep, we forget the grudge and we weep alongside. Third, if you think you are secure in what you have earned and erected, your situation is sure to change. Verse 15, as you have done, it will be done to you. Jesus' words, he who humbles himself will be exalted. He who exalts himself will be humbled. Remember the characteristics of pride now. Keep them in mind. Self-sufficiency, self-righteousness, and a self-appointed critic attitude. The judgmental attitude. And let me put it this way. The one who detects flaws, and that's almost all they can see, or when the name is mentioned, the flaw comes to mind. That's the self-appointed critic. Not a wise discernment that's needed by in the whole issue of a correct appraisal of character. Not that. But that sense of holding that grudge or knowing that weakness, and whenever that person is mentioned, there it comes again. There it is again. Mentioned again. Mentioned again. Why, how could any of us exist very long if those about us treated us in that manner? One great, when criticized, said, oh, if they knew about me what I know, what could they talk about? How much more? I suppose, to put it in today's vernacular, let's put to bed the grudges. And there may be only one or two existent. It is best to lay them aside. Put them aside. Because if you don't, the severity of the whole issue will fall upon you. What a strange people were the Edomites, fleshly minded, having no dreams, living for spoil and vengeance, no national conscience, no sense of morality, just for today. I never know in the day-to-day operation of life why God has certain messages for certain times, but I know that this has not fallen on deaf ears. I needed to hear it. You need to hear it too. He that exalts himself will be humbled. May we pray. We've really enjoyed one another because of your presence this evening, Father. It's great to know we're not alone in a cold world, moving rapidly toward a destiny that includes doom. We thank you for the security there is in the name of the Lord our God. We hold him up as our high shield, our refuge, our very present help in time of need. Our help in raising our families, our help in living out our lives, whether with a busy brood of small ones or an empty nest. We need you. We need your attitude on living. We need your help to guard against the imaginings of our own flesh. We lean upon you this week as we face it in the whole barrage of this era in which we live. We would be the first to declare our weakness, our tendency toward holding grudges, and the great sin that we all wrestle with, the sin of pride, pride of name or position or authority or even of race, nationality. Show us what it means indeed to be an authentic servant, a people helper, a caring individual, a forgiver, a lover, and a trophy of grace. We really rejoice in the work you're doing in so many lives these days. With all of the attack and assault of the enemy, you're still building your church. And we thank you for that we're a part of that building. Assist us, young and old alike, in the stretching, demanding arena of our world. And simply we ask to make us like Christ, the epitome of humility. In his name we pray, and in his name we go, for Jesus' sake. Amen.
The preceding message, Obadiah, Strong Warning to the Proud, was copyrighted in 1980, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2011 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide.